Hi, this is Edward Jensen, host of the Downtown Phoenix podcast. We want to begin series two of the podcast by saying that this is not the first episode of series two of the podcast. As we were going through over the past couple days editing our series two premiere, we realized that some of the content of that episode just did not pass the high standard of excellence test that we hold ourselves to on the podcast. So we're going to spend the next couple of weeks tweaking it and making sure that what we present to you on Monday, July 21st, holds a very high standard of excellence for not only Phoenix, but all cities. So please stick around for that. In the meantime, since we promised you an episode today, I'm going to replay my conversation I had with Feliciano Vera back in April of this year, April 2014. We talked transportation issues, but I think it provides a good context for what we are going to do in series two episodes of the Downtown Phoenix podcast. So we'll play the title music and I'll have some announcements about some things happening in the life of the Downtown Phoenix podcast. And then we'll replay my interview with Feliciano. So please stick around and join us, won't you? Welcome back to this special interim episode of the Downtown Phoenix podcast between series one and two. We have a couple of announcements that we want to share with you, and then we'll get to our conversation from April with Feliciano Vera. Since we last met at the end of April, we changed our websites and the servers on which our website was hosted. Don't worry, our website is still downtownphoenixpodcast.com, and we're still on Facebook and Twitter in the usual locations. If you found this podcast episode appeared in your podcast catching app, whether it be iTunes or whatever you use, then you're good. But if not, go to our website and follow the instructions there. And back in May, and in conjunction with our presenting organization, we announced the launch of the Urban Book Club, an urban-centric book group that, like this podcast, is a book club of action. Our first book will be Edward Glaser's Triumph of the City, which is available in bookstores and online. We'll announce more information about the Urban Book Club later on in episodes of this podcast, but you can find some preliminary information about it on our website, downtownphoenixpodcast.com/urban book club. I should note that some elements of series two episodes of the podcast will use Glaser's book, Triumph of the City, to set the stage. So even if you're not going to be a part of the Urban Book Club, then I highly recommend it to your summer reading list. A native of Phoenix, but a student of cities and urban environments around the world, Feliciano is a developer that understands the unique urban condition of Phoenix. He joined me on the 11th of April, 2014, in the Downtown Phoenix, Inc. studio. I asked him first what his story is.
I was a latchkey kid growing up. My father was a firefighter, retired in the not-too-distant past from the Phoenix Fire Department. My mother was an account clerk for the city of Phoenix. And if you know anything about public safety officers and the way their lives kind of work, as is it in Phoenix at least, firefighters are on 24 hours and they're off 48 hours. So what that meant for me is as a nine-year-old, my dad, had every third day off. And so there came a point where my mom was working and the decision was that, hey, you know, every third day, you're going to have to take the bus, not the city bus, the city bus, home. And, you're going to have to take your brother with you. And you guys are going to have to chill out for a couple of hours before we get home. So you've got chores you got to do. And so we looked at it as a big adventure. And so I grew up at the base of South Mountain, off of 16th Street and Baseline. So this was when there were nothing but flower orchard, Japanese flower gardens, orchards. Baseline was a two-lane street. It was still very, very much a rural agrarian community. But because of the way the city evolved, it was an agrarian community that was that had a large Chicano population, a large African-American population, large Eastern European population. And so the communities that you know, evolved from really what called the you know, late 40s, so early post-war years to my childhood, it was a very integrated community. So when I caught the bus, I caught the bus at 7th Street and Alta Vista, which is right next to El Reposo Park. I learned very early on what it was like to be independent via transit. And that's kind of an oxymoron in this town, and a lot of, you know, but as a 9-year-old, as a kid, I mean, being able to catch a bus unsupervised without your parents is incredibly liberating, and so I had this tremendous amount of freedom that my parents invested in us, and fortunately we demonstrated that we were capable of taking care of ourselves, and that freedom continued to grow, and so leading up to a point where I didn't get my driver's license until the day before I left for college in Boston. And the only reason I got my driver's license was because I needed an identification to open up a bank account. So I didn't have the typical experience of most kids most folks my age where the coming of age story was really wrapped around getting a car. I mean, my parents on my 16th birthday, gave me a car. Unfortunately, it was a scale model of a Volkswagen Beetle, and so you had to have a thick skin in my house. So for me, I had a very, very different way of looking at the world, and so transitioning from those experiences growing up to Boston as a college student, it opened up my mind to this really jarring contrast between the way Phoenix worked and operated and the way a city like Boston worked and operated. Now, Boston obviously is almost 400 years old. We've got some anniversaries here coming up, in fact, in the next 2 decades. Harvard, my alma mater is going to be 400 years old in 22 years. So it's kind of scary. So these are cities. This is a region that has had very, very different built form and urban environment as a consequence of its age, because these are cities that evolved when pre-motorized transportation, and so they evolved around old cattle trails, old footpaths, and so from an automotive perspective, they're very tough to navigate, and you really have to know the cities. Whereas Phoenix, I mean, being the post-war city that it is, it really evolved around the automobile as a primary mode of transit, transportation, and that kind of left us in a situation where we didn't have the kind of robust connections that other cities have. And what I began to find in Boston was that it was perfectly acceptable and perfectly normal to take public transit. You take the red line, and you're on the red line with professors, with investment bankers, with lawyers, with officials and executives that are reading a copy of the Globe, reading a copy of the Times, reading a copy of the Wall Street Journal, and they're right alongside kids that are going to school, right alongside folks that are going to go work at the local bodega or fast food restaurant, and so it was a very, very different, very liberating experience. You could live a complete life without being tied to a car. And as a young man, that really impacted the way I began to think about my hometown and my city, and the limits that we put on ourselves, without any malice aforethought. It was more a matter of, well, hey, this is the technology and this is what people want. We're reacting to what the market's telling us, but not necessarily thinking that through, thinking what that means from a competitiveness standpoint, from a civil society standpoint. And I would argue that we're in a very unique position now in 2014, where we're beginning to wrestle with the realities that hey, a robust civil society, a robust public life is absolutely integral to the efficient functioning of our markets. And we're seeing that. We're seeing those connections we're seeing those connections online. We're seeing those connections physically in the form of any number of commentaries that are starting to evolve, or that you're starting to that I see regularly and I read regularly about the way markets like, again, Boston function, San Francisco, New York City, all of these cities that are have fairly compact footprints that have very robust public environments and happen to have the economic engines that are largely driving innovation in this country. And that innovation, you know, doesn't occur in a vacuum. It occurs within the context of these robust networks of connections, these robust networks of places where people can connect and can talk. You know, the coffee houses were where this country was created. The Boston coffee houses and pubs were where the revolutionary ideas that gave birth to our nation were created. And that's no accident. It's because we as human beings are social creatures, and we, you know, we crave that interaction, we crave that contact. And what we've done here in Phoenix, again, as a, you know, again, without being malicious about it, we've created a built environment that is very much antithetical to this idea of connection, this idea of conversation. And if it's antithetical to this idea of conversation, where it's very easy to get into your car in a garage, in your garage, drive out your garage and into either your garage or your parking lot where your job is, and not deal with anybody, you know, not even really talk with your fellow drivers. It's very easy to just exist in a bubble and to kind of get isolated and trapped in that, you know, in that absence of conversation. And so arguably we've got a built environment that has a very, very poor set of social connections and a very, very weak social fabric that doesn't necessarily lend itself to strengthening our economy and in our competitive position to inspire and attract creatives, thought leaders, business leaders, and capital. But we're fixing that. We're fixing that. The first markers were put on the table by Mayor Goddard in the 80s with the failed Beltrans initiative. The torch continued to be carried by Mayor Johnson up into 1994 on a regional level when we failed to secure reauthorization of Prop 400. But Mayor Rimza was really, I think, in our lifetimes, the one mayor who was absolutely critical in exploring, you know, helping us explore some alternative futures for Phoenix and the Phoenix metropolitan region, when he pushed for the 1997 Keep Phoenix Moving transit referendum. And when that failed by 122 votes, he was pissed. And he had every reason to be, because it was so incredibly close. And really, there were any number of reasons that the failure of that election could be attributed to. But he was determined, he was dogged, and he went out. He had a fire in his belly after that loss, and we were successful in passing Transit 2000 in March of 2000, less than 18 months. Less than 18 months after. Well, I take that back. What, 24? Anyway, it's two, three years after the passage or the failure of the 1997 Keep Phoenix Moving campaign, and so we haven't looked back ever since. Now we're on the precipice of something hopefully even greater. I mean, we've got a legion of users, a legion of folks that are beginning to understand that have developed lifestyles around the utilization of transit, around riding their bikes, around really, you know, a lifestyle that doesn't have a car at the center of it. And they're aggregating in Central Phoenix, they're aggregating in Tempe, they're aggregating in the urban core, and they're beginning to find out that, hey, you know what, I'm not the only crazy one that thinks that this is possible. And so what you're seeing is this groundswell of support that is informed by real life experience that Phoenix is actually a wonderful place to live and work and play. And guess what? To do that, you don't necessarily need a car. It's a secret. You know, it's largely a secret right now. But mm-hmm. but they're starting to get the word out. And so on Tuesday, there were a couple of momentous things that happened. This past Tuesday, the city council approved on a 9-0 vote an issue near and dear to your heart. I know they approved the master plan for Hance Park, which is a critical piece of civic infrastructure in downtown Phoenix. But immediately after that, made a motion to impanel a 35-person citizen committee to study how we continue and potentially expand our transit funding as well as funding for our streets infrastructure. City staff gets it. I think, you know, I think that the public gets it, business community starting to get it. And so all of which is to say that's a long-winded way of getting back to the point. That's kind of how I got here. Mm-hmm. So.
And I note that both Feliciano and I both serve on the ad hoc bicycling and pedestrian task force with the city of Phoenix. And I think there's a lot of good work that's happening in that group. And I think the group that is there, both the citizens but also the staff, I think that we collectively get it.
I would say yes. I think that we're in a very, very this is a shift. There's a generational shift that's occurring in leadership within the city organization, within the city writ large, and our region, and it's an historic shift from the mores and temperaments of the baby boomers to the mores and temperaments of the millennials. I'm squished in between because I'm an Xer, but I was always a statistical anomaly in terms of my taste. So I never know where I fit in. Having said that, it's a really, really profound time, I think. And, mm-hmm. and there are some magnificent changes that are occurring that I think are going to benefit our ability to compete, to attract talent and retain talent,
right?
And that was something that I picked up on it at the Reinvent Phoenix closing last Friday when the folks from Duane Platter Zyberg made their concluding presentation, and one of the points that they made was that, you know, Phoenix is actually beginning to retain its talent. It's young people. So our students that are from ASU and the other universities and community colleges and colleges here in the metropolitan region are beginning to look at Phoenix as being someplace that they want to stay. It's not the Phoenix that I grew up in, where, you know, if you grew up here, you wanted to get out of Dodge as quickly as you could if you had the opportunity to get out. And so it was an anathema for me to come back to Phoenix. I could have easily been an investment banker on Wall Street. I could have been a congressional staffer. Instead, I made the decision to come back home. And I think for me, a lot of that was because of the opportunity that I began to see just by walking the streets and having those experiences as a bus rider, as a subway rider in Boston, and as somebody who just spent a lot of time thinking about what this place could be.
Exactly. Every time, apropos to your comments about Boston again, every time I've heard you make some sort of public speech or remarks to something, you always reference the former mayor of Bogota, Enrique Peñalosa. This is not to inquire if you're part of the Enrique Peñalosa Phoenix Appreciation Society.
I blame it all on Teresa Bryce from LISC.
we will certainly note that. But I'm looking at some quotes of the former mayor of Bogota. And I think one of them, which I've heard you mention before, an advanced city is not a place where the poor move about in cars, but it's where the rich use public transportation.
Yes.
I took on my way to record this conversation with you, Feliciano, I took light rail from where I live up at near the Heard Museum to here in downtown Phoenix. And we're not there yet. I don't think it's getting better. I think more socioeconomic diversity on light rail, but I think there's still, and others have commented that there's still some classism with public
absolutely public absolutely. I mean the reality is that when we fought to secure passage of Keep Phoenix Moving and eventually won passage of Transit 2000, there was a substantial undercurrent of nobody's going to ride it, and it's just nothing but a bunch of poor folk that are going to ride it. Well, yeah, that's true. I mean, there's a good chunk of our population that is transit dependent, but there's nothing wrong with that. And there's nothing wrong with investing in tools and in infrastructure that enhance access to opportunity. I mean, what's more American than wanting an opportunity nothing's guaranteed in this life, but if you've got an opportunity to improve your situation, to improve your lot in life, then we should avail ourselves of that. And that's something that we haven't really thought of here. I mean, our transportation infrastructure and our investments in transit are arguably an investment in those constitutive components of economic freedom and of self-reliance, because they provide a very meaningful way for people to access employment opportunities, to access business opportunities, to access educational opportunities. And so what fascinates me about Peñalosa is that here's a gentleman that really took the helm of a city that was arguably in dire circumstances. He was mayor of Bogota in the early part of the 2000s. Still very much an active politician, but this is a gentleman that really was looking at a city that was weighed down by the burden of an initial collapse in civic infrastructure that was a function of the narco trafficking that paralyzed the entire country for many, many years, in the early post-Civil War years in Colombia, he really started driving home some points about that very notion that, hey, you know what, if we want people to access work, access the basic, component parts of life, we have to be able to make sure that people have good sidewalks, that we have good bike infrastructure, that we have good transit infrastructure, because a lot of folks in his community, couldn't afford a car, and so as I look at kind of that bold leadership that he inspired and he undertook, he single-handedly transformed a city, and his perspective, I think, has opened up a lot of eyes in terms of what is possible and why it's possible, and really I think what is possible with very, very limited resources and just some simple changes in language and whether that's policy language or just public language about how we view our streets as cousins of parks, or our sidewalks as cousins of parks and not of streets, and he fought this idea that that, hey, parking is a right, because it's not a constitutional right anywhere in the world. And so for him, that was a huge war, because they didn't have in Bogota, there's very little parking infrastructure too. And so you have this very real fight going on a day-to-day basis on sidewalks where cars would park and force pedestrians to walk in the middle of the streets. And so the conflicts between pedestrians and bicyclists and cars were much more profound than they are here. But he really pushed home this notion that equity isn't about giving anything away. This is about having a well-functioning, well-oiled market, a well-functioning, well-oiled civil society that supports that market and that plays off of that market and informs how that grows. So it suggests that we kind of limit our vocabulary about the possibilities that can occur here in a place like Phoenix. And I think that we've got some exciting opportunities to really buttress the strengthening, buttress the market here, and while at the same time strengthening our civil fabric.
I think that's an excellent note on which to end. Feliciano Vera, thanks for spending some time with us.
Thank you, Ed. Appreciate it.
We will be back with more of the Downtown Phoenix podcast, this special interim episode, and a new feature after this. We are introducing a new feature on the Downtown Phoenix podcast that we hope you enjoy. We call it This Week in Downtown Phoenix History. Thursday, July 10th, will mark the 6th anniversary of Metro Light Rail's first appearance in downtown Phoenix. At a bit past 10 a.m., the first train turned north onto Central Avenue from Washington Street with local dignitaries on board. The train sat at the Washington platform for about an hour for curious downtown dwellers and office workers to explore the new trains. That first train ultimately went up to McDowell Road to test out the tracks before backing up and heading back home. So now that you know that, we're beginning Series 2 in actuality in 2 weeks' time, Monday, July 21st. Please note, Series 2 episodes will be released in the afternoons, about 1 or 2 p.m., as opposed to our Series 1 release time of 8 a.m. in the morning. We'll be taking a week off, so please note Series 2 begins Monday, July 21st. And this week on our website, downtownphoenixpodcast.com, we'll begin posting some of our initial framework for The Serious City, which is going to be the theme of Series 2 episodes. And while you're on our website, you can find our community calendar, read more about the Urban Book Club, and explore our new community forums. It's a place for you to check out and to engage with other Downtown Phoenix podcast listeners and Downtown Phoenix friends to talk and engage each other on conversations about Downtown Phoenix. All that is online at our website, again, downtownphoenixpodcast.com. Reminder that we are on Facebook at facebook.com/downtownphoenixpodcast, and on Twitter, our username is DTPHXpodcast. So thanks for joining us for the special interim episode, and apologies that Series 2 didn't actually begin today. We will be back July 21st for the series premiere of Series 2. So long. This is the Downtown Phoenix Podcast, an Edward Jensen Urban Production.